activities and human interaction. It's not welcome to Chats from the Mat, yoga-inspired conversations with Brian McCray Davis. After this, we'll go out for a rip, eh?
And I remember even thinking that, like, wouldn't it be cool to be on the cover of Yoga Journal? That, like, intention that I set out to the universe came back to me in this other form. Like, there I am, still on the cover. It's my pants, though. Yeah. It's something I created that is on the cover.
My conversation in this episode of Chats from the Mat is with Leah Emmett, who is the owner and founder of Inner Fire Brand Clothing. As she puts it, she left a 40-hour-a-week job to become an entrepreneur with an 80-hour-a-week job. Her journey began with Bikram, and after an injury, she transitioned into an exploration of other styles. She discovered Moksha Yoga and became enamored with their commitment to the yoga off of the mat, as well as what happens in the asana practice. It didn't take long for Leah to realize that she wanted to become a yoga teacher. Leah had been a yoga teacher for about 6 months and suffered a serious medical emergency. She took time off to rest and recover. During her convalescence, she began to create and sell small products through Facebook to her friends. The inspiration to do this came out of the blue. While she was driving, she suddenly had to pull over and write down a few slogans. Over time, Leah's business grew. It began small and grew organically. When she finally committed to the business full-time, she found herself with more time because she was no longer trying to juggle multiple commitments. In the beginning, Leah sold shirts with slogans, and while she continues to do so, her brand has evolved to add leggings and athletic tops with creative designs. Many designs are inspired by traditional patterns from Africa and other indigenous cultures. Leah designs what she wants to wear and designs with the intention that it should last longer than one season. She still handles many of the tasks within the company herself. In fact, you can often find her working the booth at each of the 6 Wanderlust festivals around the country. Leah has very graciously offered a 15% coupon to any listener of Chats from the Mat. It is valid on anything on the website until April 30th, 2018, and I will give you that coupon at the end of the podcast. In April, Inner Fire is releasing a new collection called Elevate Spring 18. You will find a few sneak peeks at the bottom of the show notes. During our conversation, Leah mentions her Entrepreneurship Accelerator program, which I also link to in the show notes. You'll also find there links to her social media, as well as the website myinnerfire.com. During the conversation, there is some background noise because we recorded in a common room in the hotel at the Wanderlust Festival in Mont-Tremblant. I would like to thank, for providing the introduction to this episode, another Canadian by the name of Tony Vendrasco. Tell me your name, please.
So my name is Leah Emmett, and I'm the founder and owner of Inner Fire Apparel.
And where are we, Leah?
We're in Mont-Tremblant, Quebec, a beautiful lakeside town and ski village.
And why are we here?
We're at Wanderlust Festival, which is a 4-day-long event that brings yogis up to ski resorts to have beautiful, blissful experiences.
And why in particular are you here?
I'm here because my company, Inner Fire, is we're vending, so we've got our little booth set up in the main village.
And is this your livelihood? This is how you make money?
Mm-hmm. Yep. This is my full-time, I would say full-time plus job. Because, you know, entrepreneur thing is you leave your 40-hour-a-week job to have an 80-hour-a-week job.
Yes,
that's how it works.
And how did you get into the business of selling and presumably designing clothes?
Yeah. I design. So my backstory is that I was a yoga teacher. So I did my yoga teacher training and was basically teaching full time in 2011. And I had an event where I had an ovarian cyst that I didn't even know about, but it had twisted and I was in intense pain. I had to go to the hospital and go in for emergency surgery. And that was when I was teaching quite a bit. So I had to press pause on my life at the moment and at the time rather, and just take time off to rest. So when I was doing that, I started to get super creative. I really felt like what had happened was I had this mass in my belly that got removed and that my creativity just started to blossom from there. And I started making some things. I started doing, I reverse engineered some yoga props that I already owned and started sewing them. And I learned how to screen print when I was feeling a little bit better after the surgery, and started designing shirts. And I have a little bit of a background in graphic design and marketing that I had studied when I was back in school, and worked a little bit in the corporate world after that, until I just became kind of fed up with it and started to become a yoga teacher, or decided to take that path. So I started making things and sold it on the side to some of my friends, and was very, very low-key about it. I took some photos, put them up on Facebook, and asked my friends, oh, I made some stuff, does anyone want any? And it was kind of around Christmas time too, so I was making gifts primarily. And people were really jamming with it. I was doing things that were, like for my shirt designs, I was sort of doing humorous, punny shirts. Like, I'm just here for the Shavasana was sort of the way it started. Was I wanted to express my own view on yoga, which is that it doesn't have to be so serious. And I think people were starting to resonate with that more and more, and started making things. So, long story short, I was sort of, after I had sold a few of these, I realized I had to start calling it something because people were asking me for it. And so I realized that when I had that cyst removed, I felt like my inner fire got ignited. That spark happened in me. And so that's why I decided to call it Inner Fire, because I truly felt like that physical mask was replaced by that flame, and it has been basically lit ever since.
That's a great story.
Yeah, yeah, wow. It's pretty cool.
That definitely is. So the trauma, I'm assuming there was probably some fear and all that as well, and it began a new chapter in your life.
Yeah, it was like, you know, when you have those events in your life that take you on a different path completely, it was definitely one of those things where I thought I was going to be a full-time yoga teacher. I had visions to open up my own yoga studio one day, but then this thing happened and it totally changed my direction. I remember feeling so creative, and it was this like renewed excitement that I hadn't really felt in years. And I really feel like it was this space that was created from this removal of, you know, this mass. It was quite large. It was about the size of a grapefruit.
Oh, wow.
And I had no idea I had it. And I thought I was really self-aware and healthy because I was a yoga teacher. But, you know, little did I know that I was, my body was housing this gigantic ball of, you know, cells. That it was a benign tumor, basically. So, yeah, and that was what really led me along this more creative path, and also gave me a newfound courage. Like, I was starting to take more and more risks. It didn't seem weird for me to invest in, you know, buying up a bunch of fabric or buying up shirt blanks. And I just felt like I was ready to take on these new challenges. And before, I was pretty risk adverse. So it changed that in me as well.
So the first of all, I'm assuming that part of it might have had something to do with the fact that you were bedridden for a little while, and so what do you do with your attention and your mind?
Yeah.
Where do you think that suddenly the loss of risk aversion came from?
I think it was a reaction to the positive. At first, I really didn't know if anybody would want any of this stuff, and I didn't really care because I was just putting it out there and making stuff that I would want to wear myself, or things that I would want to gift to other people. But when other people were giving me more encouragement and saying, hey, yeah, this is really awesome. I remember my yoga studio picked up a few pieces and sold them wholesale, like right at the beginning. And I was like, oh my God, I have a wholesale customer. Like, what is this?
That's great.
It's actually, you know, in a shop somewhere. And that's what really kind of gave me that little newfound courage to just keep going. And I think that was what also made me realize that my community was my biggest asset. And like at that time, I, you know, I had a lot of people within my community because I, the style of yoga that I was teaching at the time was Moksha yoga, which is also known as Modo yoga in the US, but it's a pretty well-known yoga chain in Canada. And as a teacher, you kind of are able to get tapped into the whole community of teachers. And so when you stick something up online, you get all these people that are super down with what you're doing, or they're, you know, it's up, you get this broader net that gets cast. And so that was really what kind of gave me that encouragement to keep going, was how the community responded back to what I was doing. So I owe it back to that community, and I still kind of feel like that's the most important thing that kind of got me going, was the support from everyone around me. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really, I don't think it really came from within. I still had lots of doubts. And I did move home. Like I remember after a couple of months, I was ready to, like, you know, put more money into it. And so I moved back home, which was a huge challenge. Living with my parents again and trying to juggle this new life, and spending a lot of extra nights. And because I was still working full time, it was this extra project that I would take on. And I remember spending all my extra time on it, and to the point where I realized I needed to make a decision and start to take it seriously and go with it. So at that point, then I started to reduce my teaching hours and focus on it full time, because I knew that the business was sort of required something more of me in order to keep going and in order to take it to that next level. So that was a hard decision too, is just, do I take this full time? Am I going to be able to support myself? All these big questions of, you know, uncertainty. But I just sort of kept on just staying true to what I wanted to do, which was to inspire people with sayings and designs. Because at first I only did the shirts. I didn't do any of the leggings. So it was really about the messages that I put on these shirts that resonated with people, either on a like funny level or on an inspirational level. And then I started to get into the other parts of the business, which actually ended up being a pretty smooth transition. But I also had to learn, like, I don't have a background in textiles or fashion. I only have a background in graphic design, so I had no idea how the clothing industry worked at all. So it was all learning, but also enjoy the challenge of learning about new industries, and maybe what I don't know is better. Because I think now, knowing what I do know, I probably wouldn't have started in the first place, because I would have been like, nah, that's too much work. But I didn't know how much work was in it, so I just kind of kept on piling stuff onto my plate, and then I, you know, was able to take it on.
Now, did you have a mentor or someone you could turn to for advice, or were you learning all on your own?
I did have a mentor. I was pretty lucky that early on, I remember doing a small little event, and I met this man who actually had his own skateboard brand. And he was super supportive and was like, hey, anytime you have any questions about the industry, just let me know. And so he was sort of my unofficial mentor. We sort of met up every couple months for coffee, and I would ask him questions like, how do you put barcodes on things? Or I don't know how this works. Or how do you start your own e-commerce store? So he was super helpful. And then later on, I got an official mentor as well, who also owns a clothing company. And that was super beneficial. I don't think that I would have been able to really make it past year 3 and 4 without him.
Now, what's the difference between an unofficial and official mentor?
So an unofficial mentor is, you know, you just call them when you need help. You don't have scheduled meetings. Mm-hmm. Whereas the official mentor, we met up once a month and we would go over. And I also had a group there that would be 4 of us, that we're all entrepreneurs and in different businesses. And so we would meet with the same mentor, and we would have 3-hour sessions every month. And we would just have sessions of talking about what our challenges are, what our wins are. And that was set up by an organization. So that helped me a lot, because they were able to set us up with people who were definitely established in their industry and were able to, you know, be there for us on a regular basis. So that helped a lot.
And was this a service that you were paying for?
Yeah. Yeah. It was it's called EO. So EO stands for Entrepreneurs Organization, which is a global organization. And EO has a program called EO Accelerator. And they set you up with your mentor, your accountability group, which is the other entrepreneurs in your group, as well as structured days called learning days. So they bring you in every quarter and you get to learn about certain aspects of running a business. And so that was super useful. But yeah, we did pay for it, but it was definitely pretty reasonable.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I know, well, from hearing your story, there were certain things that you were sort of, you know, flying by the seat of your pants, learning as you went and, mm-hmm. and making mistakes, of course, along the way. And then there was also, it sounds like, a point where you recognized there was some things that are worth paying for. Mm-hmm. In this case, a mentor, you know, some mm-hmm. someone to provide knowledge, people that you were accountable to. I think that a lot of people, when they're beginning, that's something that people struggle with, is recognizing when it makes sense to pay. How did you mm-hmm. come across that? How did you make that decision? Like, now I need more.
Yeah. Well, I think I learned pretty early on that there's only certain things I'm really good at, and I'll try to do it. I'll take one stab at it. And if I can't really succeed at that, I'm going to find someone else to help me. That was the case when it came to photography, for example. So I remember at the beginning, I would try and take all my own pictures and do all my own product photos, do my own photo shoots. And then I realized it's worth its weight in gold getting a good photographer. Because that's how you, portray your brand. And if you don't look professional, then people aren't going to really pick up on you. So I thought that, I kind of kept on following that philosophy as I went through, because it's also my time. And I think at the beginning I had a lot more time, so I was able to try and figure things out, which I think was also very useful, like trying to build your own website. Those are all things I tried to do at the beginning, and I remember spending so much time on it. But then at the end of the day, that time is worth a lot. And if we don't value our time, then we're not going to really be able to do what we do best. And that was something that my mentor told me at the very beginning, my unofficial mentor, actually. He was like, yeah, you know, it's easy to slave away at things, especially when you're still involved with the production. I was still screen printing all the shirts myself. I was still responding to every single email. I was still doing every single event. And I still do a lot of things that I probably shouldn't be doing at this point in my career. But knowing that my time should be spent doing the things I'm best at was mm-hmm. a huge lesson.
And what was the first job that you paid someone else to do for you?
Yeah, so my first hire was a screen printer and a fulfillment person. She was the one who, because I actually got carpal tunnel from screen printing too much.
Really?
Yeah, my wrist just couldn't do it, and I still have wrist issues because of it. So I hired her, and that was actually a big step for me, because hiring her meant that I had to actually get a proper space too, because I was running the business out of my dad's house. And that was an interesting learning as well, because trying to find a commercial space for cheap was, and I gave myself a budget of like $500 a month. I wasn't going to spend more than that. So I actually found this used car place, and I shared my office and production space with used car salesmen. And it was totally weird. There would people would walk in looking to buy a car, and they'd see shirts flying around, and like, but they were totally cool, and I was cool. I learned a lot about selling used cars, actually, in the process. But as soon as I had that space, then I was able to hire this person. And she was able to take on the fulfillment, because I mean, we were selling a fair amount online at the time, and I was still packing every order and going to the post office and shipping stuff out. And that just was so time consuming for me. And I wouldn't have enough time to work on the marketing, which is what I was really doing, from the very beginning, trying to use my background as, I went to business school and I studied marketing. So I was trying to really leverage what I knew about marketing. Of course, it changes like every 6 months or less, you know, like the world mm-hmm. of marketing now is accelerated. What I learned back in school is not what I'm doing right now, but it was, the branding, you know, always trying to make sure that I was connecting with the right people. And so you do have to go out there and connect yourself. So I was really fortunate to find someone to help me with that.
Let's loop back to the beginning, to the yoga.
Sure.
Do you remember your first yoga class?
I do. So my first yoga class was a Bikram class. And I remember showing up with one of those 4-liter milk jugs full of water because I didn't know how much I would sweat. And I wore a bikini, which was like hilarious because I was just told, like, I guess the Bikram culture at the time was very much like, you just have to wear like the least amount of stuff possible.
Yes.
So I'm like, well, I don't have a sports bra, so I'm just going to wear a bikini and shorty, like a bikini top and shorty shorts. And I walked into this class feeling really weird about it. But it was fine. And I didn't sweat nearly as much as I thought I would. I didn't need to chug the 4-liter milk jug of water.
Really?
Yeah. But I was really hooked. Actually, the reason I started yoga is because I used to be a runner, and I used to do triathlons, and my body was just super tight. And one of my friends from high school was like, you should totally try this new style yoga called Bikram yoga. It's hot and you sweat a ton. And so I actually started out my yoga journey as like a Bikram practitioner. Mm-hmm. So I got a membership and started practicing like crazy. And then I ended up getting injured. I got a back injury from going back. Well, the Bikram style, unfortunately, is kind of pushy, and it doesn't encourage you necessarily to like go inwards and know your limits. So I pushed myself too far and stopped doing Bikram because I couldn't. So I actually started looking around for other forms of yoga, and there was this this card that you could get. It was called Passport to Prana, and you could pay one flat fee and be able to take one class at a whole bunch of different studios. So I picked that up and was able to just discover lots of different styles, which totally changed my outlook on yoga. And I didn't realize that yoga was all these other things. So I tried every single different class I could. I took hatha classes. I took vinyasa. I took yin. I took kundalini classes. And then finally sort of found my yoga home back at back to hot yoga again, actually, which is the moksha style, which is what I ended up being certified in. I kind of fell in love with it right from the beginning, though. It was one of those things that it changed me for sure.
Now, when you were going through that process of trying all those classes, I mean, was it did your interest fixate on one for a while and then transition, or was it more, I took this class, oh, that was interesting, let's go take the next class and move on?
Yeah, I was kind of I just floated around, actually. I even blogged about it. I had a little blog that I started, and I just reviewed different types of classes. Because I also have a background in fitness, so I used to teach a lot of different types of fitness classes as well. I teach Pilates too. And so I always like to learn from different teachers and take different classes. And at the time, online yoga wasn't really a thing. So I wasn't able to experience lots of different teachers in any other way other than just going to lots of different types of classes. Mm-hmm. But I've always been open to trying different things. That's kind of my personality.
And so then moksha, you were taking moksha yoga for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point you decided you wanted to be a teacher.
Yeah.
How long from when your first Bikram class to the time you decided you wanted to become a yoga teacher?
I would say probably, let's see, the first teacher training I did, actually, to be very honest, moksha wasn't the first teacher training I took.
Okay.
I actually took another one before that, about a year prior, because one of my best friends had taken it, and she just was like, oh, you like yoga? You should take this teacher training. And for me, it was like, oh, I'm just going to learn more? Cool. So I actually ended up taking my first teacher training in 2009, and it was very traditional. It was by this woman named Shakti Mai, and she was very much on the spiritual side of yoga. So I started practicing yoga, I guess, probably 6 years or so before I took my yoga teacher training.
You took some time with it.
I took some time. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, maybe more than 6 years, I would say, because when I think about it, when I was in high school, like I started practicing yoga when I was about 17.
Oh.
And then I took my first teacher training, I've got to do some math now in my head, 2009. So that was, yeah, like 13 years. No, wait. Oh, gosh, you might have to edit this out. What's the math? In 2009, I was 24. Yeah, so...
So this is good for future entrepreneurs to know you don't have to be stellar at math in order to have a successful business.
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I was 24. Yeah, so actually, that's about 7 years from when I started. Yeah. So my first teacher training was when I was 24, 25. And then after my first teacher training, then I got hooked on teacher trainings, actually. And so I already had this background, but I didn't really teach. So I took the training and I couldn't really quite figure out how to get into actually getting hired to teach. So then I kept practicing. That's when I started to get really into moksha. And then I was like, okay, cool. Like, I've done. I know I want to become a moksha teacher. So I went and did their training and then took other supplemental trainings after that too. But that one for sure was the most intensive that I had ever done, where you're, you know, in one place for a whole month. And it's sort of like personal therapy too, right? You know, you start going through all of your shit. Really.
Sure. Absolutely.
The other trainings I did were not quite as intense. But I was really grateful to become a part of that community. It was sort of like you get welcomed into this big family.
So you took the moksha training. Mm-hmm. Did you find it easier then to go into the business of teaching, or was there still sort of a learning process there?
Yeah, I was really lucky that as soon as I finished my moksha training, a studio had opened up just in my city. So they were looking for teachers. I already had experience, you know, more experience than the average person because I had background training. And so I just jumped right into teaching. And then that definitely became my full-time gig. And I taught at other places as well, but it was definitely like the majority of my classes were there. And that was what really helped me kind of kickstart my teaching career. And I was, you know, you can only be teaching for a year, but if you teach 7 classes a week for a year, you're pretty experienced by then. Yeah, that was how I got a lot of my experience.
And for people that aren't familiar, how would you describe moksha yoga?
So moksha is technically a set sequence. It's similar to Bikram in the sense that there is a standing series and a floor series. It's designed to be very accessible. So all the postures are all beginner level postures, and it's heated. It's not quite as hot as a Bikram class, but it's still heated. And there's I think they have now non-heated classes. But traditionally, it was a 90-minute sequence, but it's also, they have an hour sequence. And the moksha community is very largely based on eco-friendly business practices. So all the studios have to make sure that they build out their studios with the least amount of environmental impact as possible. And it's all very focused also on community support. So they pool together a lot of their resources to do campaigns to support environmental initiatives or social initiatives. So they're just kind of good, you know, good people. And the two founders that came up with the practice used to own a Bikram studio, but sort of got I guess, disconnected from that because they just didn't really, it didn't resonate with them anymore. They didn't really like the way the Bikram business was being run. So they decided to start their own style of yoga, which is definitely flourishing. It's international now and they have a lot of studios all over the place.
So it's more than just the asana that you practice on the mat.
Yes, yes. And actually that was a really great example I saw firsthand at how well they were doing because I would see other studios in our community close down, but their studios just kept on opening up. And I think what they really did well was try to focus on community, try and make the yoga studio a place where people can go and be totally who they are and not feel judged or not feel like they, you know, have to be perfect because moksha is very much about that accessible aspect. So, you know, there's people in yoga teacher training that have physical disabilities and it was totally fine. You don't have to be the most bendy yogi in order to be able to teach yoga effectively. So I think that they really set a great example for me to to focus on community as the main cornerstone of a yoga chain, instead of like, let's just see how many people we can get through our door or see how many memberships we can sell. It was, you know, if you make this a second home, then people will come.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Now you mentioned that they have, that it's the sequence is beginner friendly. Is there mm-hmm. only one sequence, or do they have more levels than that?
They have a flow sequence as well, which they introduced a little bit later, which is its own separate training. But yeah, no, they actually, for a while there, a lot of their teachers started to kind of freestyle and take it their own way, because the way they sort of present it is that here's the sequence. Make sure you teach about 85% of the sequence, and then you can modify 15% of it. But people were sort of taking a little bit more liberties, and then they actually had to do a little bit of an intervention and say, let's all stick back to the sequence, because I think they wanted to stay true to that. And they also wanted people, their practitioners, if they were to show up in a different city, to know what they were expecting. That consistency was important to them. But yeah, like certain studios definitely offer different things. Each studio is different for sure. But I think at the core of it, that moksha sequence is the main cornerstone, and they try and keep that as a consistent thing throughout.
And so you were teaching full time?
Yeah, nearly full time. Like I was actually still working a little bit on the side, doing some freelance marketing work too. So I was busy. I'm the kind of person that if my schedule is if I have breaks in my schedule, I'll fill it with something. Like that's always how things go with my life, which is sort of my struggle, is to try and find the quiet times or the personal times, because I'll always try and take on more. And it's been good for growing a business, but for my personal life, it can actually be pretty detrimental, because I'll have no time, and friends will be like, I'm sorry, I haven't called you in forever, but I can see that you have no time for anything like social or, you know, the things regular people do, like hang out at the beach. It doesn't happen for me. So, but yeah, I was basically teaching full time at the time.
And so that was where you were in your life when you had the mm-hmm. scare, when you mm-hmm. had the fun scare.
I had actually just finished teaching a triple, and I was closing up the studio, and I just had this, and I remember teaching, like the last class I was teaching, I just kept holding onto my stomach and just feeling like maybe I was just having, you know, like stomach problems. And then after I had closed up the studio, the pain had escalated really quickly, like to the point where I couldn't drive myself home. I had to call my boyfriend, and
wow.
And as soon as I got into the car, I was like, take me to the hospital, this isn't right. And what I had was ovarian torsion, which is when it turns and basically cuts off the blood supply to half of my reproductive organs. So my ovary wasn't getting any blood. So like they had to remove that as well. So yeah, it was one of those things that I was in surgery within 24 hours.
And probably lucky you didn't ignore it anymore.
Yeah. And very grateful for the Canadian healthcare system.
As an American, I'm jealous.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I didn't have to pay a penny for it, and it probably was I think about a $25,000 surgery.
Wow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So you were a yoga, you were a yoga teacher for, let's say when the yoga studio opened up, the Moksha Yoga Studio, where you started mm-hmm. teaching mostly full time.
Mm-hmm.
How long were you there before you had your life-changing experience?
I was there for about 6 months.
Oh, not very long.
Yeah. Yeah. Not very long. Yeah, I think the studio had opened in June or something. Yeah, June, and my incident happened in November.
Was the mm-hmm. Shavasana, was that yeah. your first design?
One of the first, yeah. Yeah, I remember having just a burst of inspiration. I literally had to stop. I was driving, and I literally had to pull over. And I wrote down about 10 different shirt slogans, and that was one of them. But yeah, I kind of designed them all very similar at the time too, because I just wanted to stick with like one font and just have the words be the most important thing. But yeah, I a lot of what I started out doing was like the punny stuff, because mm-hmm. that's just my personality. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But you weren't necessarily mm-hmm. looking for a career. You
No. So I didn't really know what my goals were. And actually, to be very honest, still don't really know what I want. I've been very blessed to see my company be successful over the years, but I never ever did it because I wanted to make money. That was like the last thing on my mind, to be honest. I really only just did it because I really liked seeing people get something out of what I was creating, or that, you know, they were really jiving off of the shirts I would make. And I still see that to this day. Even today, there's people who are like, yeah, I wear this shirt because it makes me feel good about myself. Like, I have a shirt that says abandoned perfection. And they were like, yeah, you know, on those days when I just feel like I have to be perfect, I put on this shirt. And that's what like really kind of gets me excited about continuing to do it. But I just never thought I would be an entrepreneur. I actually never even took any entrepreneur courses when I was in university, because I knew I was like, I'm just going to work for someone else and that'll be my career. Little did I know that the universe would sort of throw me a curveball and that I would actually be a full-on entrepreneur with staff and taking on this challenge that, of course, is like, it's very risky. Like, I poured all my life savings into this company. I didn't get any external financing at all. So I just kept on reinvesting what I made back into the company, kind of paid myself the bare minimum to survive, and then just kept on pushing on.
As your business, your life as an entrepreneur, there were certain, I guess, milestones where you had to commit a little bit more to the business. One of those points being mm-hmm. when you hired the first employee.
Yep.
Another point being when you joined the entrepreneurs group.
Yep.
So leading up to that, was it just a spontaneous, I need to do something more to invest, or was there a gradual acknowledgement that you had to go further with it?
I think it came out of exhaustion. So when I was still teaching and running the business, I just had no personal time at all. So I was working evenings on the business, working, you know, during the day, doing other stuff. And I think I remember laying on the floor sobbing, being like, I don't think I can do this anymore. Like, what have I gotten myself into? This was supposed to be fun. And then something kind of told me, like, just clear your schedule. Just, you know, the teaching will still be there. If you fail at this, you can always go back to teaching. You can always go back to freelancing. It's okay. You have a backup plan. And then that's when I told my studio, I'm like, yeah, I don't want to teach that much anymore. Like, reduce it down to 2 classes a week. And luckily they were like super supportive of that. And yeah, I just kept on. I followed that path a little further. And as soon as I took the business full time, I felt so much relief, because then I actually had the time and I didn't feel like I was working nonstop. Even though I still was technically working nonstop, it was different. It felt like I had given myself that permission to like to take it a little further and to see what happens. Like, you know, who knows? This might fail, but trying is you know half the journey anyways, just seeing how what it's like to be an entrepreneur. And also I sort of inserted myself into this entrepreneurial community as well. Just by doing events. So I started doing yoga events, started doing craft shows, and I started meeting other people who ran businesses. And that was also a really big part of the support that I got, because I didn't know how to do things. So I would ask other entrepreneurs and they would be super supportive. So I really owe it a lot to them too.
Mm-hmm. So the community is what drew you into Moksha, and the community is also what helped you go with it.
Yeah. And the community, I think, is what got me to that next level too, because for a long time, for the first couple of years, it was me. Like, this is something I create. I put it onto the world. I don't think about it. But then I started seeing it come back around, and other people would want to be a part of what I was doing. So people would call me up and say, hey, are you doing any shows in the city? Like, I'd love to help you out. Or people would be like, do you have an ambassador program? And I'm like, I don't know what that's about, but okay. Like, you can be my ambassador. Or, you know, people would be like, yeah, I'll teach in your clothes. Or I couldn't believe the amount of support I got from other people coming in. And I realized I was actually building my own community around Inner Fire, which was super cool, because I never thought that that was something I had the capability of doing. But really quickly, I realized, like, whatever I was putting out there was getting sent back to me in this other way. And I was starting to see these amazing people just show up in my life, or like opportunities just show up in my life. And it was very serendipitous. Like, there'd be moments where, like, how did I manifest that? Like, for example, a couple of years later, I had Yoga Journal call me and they asked for some samples so that they could shoot their cover. And I was like, yeah, for sure, take these. And they actually ended up choosing my pants to go on the cover of the May issue of, May 2016 issue. And I remember thinking, oh my God, like, I'm holding this magazine and there's something I've created. And it's like on the magazine that I subscribed to when I first started teaching yoga. I was like, I gotta get a subscription to Yoga Journal because that's what all the yogis read. And I remember even thinking when I was teaching yoga that, like, wouldn't it be cool to be on the cover of Yoga Journal? Like, those, you know, Yoga Journal cover girls, you know, you've really made it when you're on the cover of Yoga Journal. And then I realized, like, that, like, intention that I set out to the universe, we're yogis, right? We can talk about that. came back to me in this other form. Like, there I am, still on the cover. It's my pants, though. Yeah. It's something I created that is on the cover. I just really realized that, like, sometimes you don't know what you're sending out, but if you kind of send out something in your own true, authentic form, it will come back to you in this abundant way. But you never know what it's going to look like. So mm-hmm. I'm really grateful, actually, for all the yoga that I did and the background I have, because it has attuned me to those things more as an entrepreneur, trying to figure out, like, okay, like, I know I don't know how this is going to look or how I'm going to figure this out, but if I just kind of put the feelers out and, like, and try and keep myself attuned to what's going on, then I can probably receive that back. And there's been so many times where I've been, like, stuck and in a pinch and I'm like, I don't know how this is going to work out. Like, I need somebody to help me at this event. And then all of a sudden someone will show up miraculously and they'll just be like, yeah, I'm here. I know about you. Okay. So I've really tried to be aware of that happening. And I think it's really quite a magical thing. And it's crazy when you see it, like, fully manifesting in front of you.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that's been interesting about me doing these podcasts and talking to different people that have a business within yoga is I pick up on certain trends that multiple people have talked about. And recognizing that many of them find success or get further in life through that one particular trend. And the one thing that just occurred to me now is you and a few other people I've talked to were not necessarily looking for the career that they're in. It sort of fell into their lap, but it's not just that it fell into there. They had to then take the initiative. You had to take the initiative mm-hmm. to not recognize this as a business, but mm-hmm. to move forward with
yeah,
it.
To put the work in. Yeah, to meet it halfway, because I think we're kind of all like lightning rods. Like, we're walking around and, like, little things we'll pick up on, and, you know, little bouts of inspiration, or, you know, these subtle energies or these subtle little, like, whispers of, like, maybe you should try that or take on that challenge. And it's up to us to then take ownership of that and actually put the work into making it a reality. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of people aren't willing to do the work and sort of have these dreams. And it's great to dream, for sure. But if you don't actually start taking action, then those dreams are just going to be dreams. They're not going to become reality. But that's when like, you really kind of have to just pull up your sleeves and, like, get your hands dirty, because, and be willing to fail and be willing to, like, you know, lose some money over it, or lose some sleep over it, or lose some of your, some relationships definitely suffer because of it too, right? So I think that's, you know, definitely something that, especially with creative people, it's almost like they are presented with this opportunity, and Elizabeth Gilbert, who wrote Eat, Pray, Love, puts it really well. She says, I don't think anyone is a genius. I think they have a genius. And so in order to like let that genius express itself, you have to birth it. Like it's your job to like incubate the idea or whatever it is and then actually birth it out into the world. So it, you know, she actually fully believes that like ideas can pass from one person to another, and maybe it's your calling to do this, but if someone holds on to it for too long, maybe that idea is going to pass on to someone else and they're going to realize it's, you know, this idea is not going to get birthed out through this person. I'm going to move on to the next person. And I've seen that happen with other people too. It's kind of creepy.
Yeah. One of my pet peeves is when someone says, I can't do that type of work. I'm more of an idea person, which is really to me says, not that I'm lazy, but I can't put forth the effort. I just want to make the idea happen. I want someone else to do it for me. Mm-hmm. And I feel like, unless you're super rich and you can afford to pay lots of people to come in, you're going to have to do more than just create ideas.
Oh, yeah, for sure. And I think it's in the process that you really learn what works and what doesn't work, and also learn what you're good at. Because I didn't know what I was good at when I started the business. Like, I you know, tried to do a little bit of everything, of course, as you have to do when you're an entrepreneur. But I learned about myself through that process, which was super valuable, because I thought I knew who I was until I was met with all these challenges. And then you really know who you are when no one else is telling you what to do, because you're the boss, quote unquote. The grind is there. And if you have to choose to do the grind, and there's definitely things that you will enjoy and things that you won't enjoy. And if you pick up on that early enough and start to put people in those seats to do the stuff that you don't want to do anymore, then you actually can elevate other people, which I think is really awesome. Like when I first started hiring people to help me, I didn't realize that what I was actually doing was giving them an opportunity to excel at what they love to do. And that's a great feeling too, just knowing like, oh, cool. Like if I didn't do this, this person wouldn't have their dream job. Like I've got this one girl who, she is just so, so stoked on doing festivals and traveling around and selling her product. And she's like, this is my dream job. I can't believe I'm here at a yoga festival. And I'm like, awesome. Cause like the novelty's worn off a little bit for me. So sure, you go for it. And that's really a great feeling is, you know, when you start a company, you don't ever think that it's going to impact other people's lives that much, but it's pretty special.
So from your perspective, you're filling a niche. From her perspective, she's living the dream.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Absolutely.
Just perspective.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. For sure.
So you sell more than just shirts with catchy phrases.
Yeah. Yeah. So I also got into doing leggings because I have a graphic arts background, and I started seeing this trend of people wearing something different than black leggings. And I thought it was really cool. I also am very much involved with sustainability initiatives. And actually, throughout my university career, I'd studied specifically green biz. I worked only in green biz when I was doing all my freelancing stuff to try and get companies to think in a different way, to think about their environmental impact. And so when I saw this opportunity to maybe create clothing, I really wanted it to be something that wasn't going to just add to the world's waste. And so I looked around all over the place to find recycled fabric, recycled polyester specifically. And I was pretty lucky within the community. I had some contacts, and they were able to link me up with distributors and people that were sourcing these kinds of materials. And I remember I just called up the only sublimation printer, which is like this type of printing that we do in Vancouver. And they were like, yeah, we can totally make you some leggings. And I was like, really? Is that easy? They're like, yeah, we have a pattern already. You can just use our pattern and put your stuff on it. And so it was pretty quick, actually, and I had no idea what I was doing. I have no background in textiles, like I said. So I just made some pants and then put that on the shelf, too, and those started to sell as well. So, and the funny thing is, like, once that clothing, the clothing side of the business really started to take over, I totally dropped all the yoga props because I was still doing yoga props, sewing a lot of stuff myself, like, And the business evolved from what it originally was, which was like giftable yoga props. And I realized like this was starting to catch on, and people were really digging my art, and they were digging, you know, the aesthetic that I was putting out there, which was mainly inspired by the environment around me. So lots of West Coast imagery, lots of like nature inspired, as well as like cultural imagery. So I really like different design motifs from different cultures, Indian, Moroccan, and Asian, just because I just fall in love with those kinds of designs. And I remember going to a couple of museums and just like taking pictures for inspiration, because I really liked that Moroccan print that was on that pot, you know? So that's kind of where I draw a lot of my inspiration from, is different cultures and nature. And I think people who kind of live in the same parts of the world as, you know, people who live near the ocean and near the mountains, kind of, we're just really kind of digging that, because you didn't really see it very much in textiles at the time. Like, this was 3 years ago now, and, you know, people would just be wearing like bright neon tights, and that's totally cool too, but there wasn't a lot of stuff going on with the imagery on tights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When I was, when I went into your stall and we mm-hmm. were talking, I caught the attention, or I saw one of your pairs of leggings, and it's got the lotus, of course, because, mm-hmm. you know, with mm-hmm. yoga, it's got to have a lotus. Mm-hmm. But the pattern on the pant came, I've seen it before on an Islamic mosque, maybe not a mosque, like a ceiling or a wall.
Is it,
you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I don't know. I just like to combine things that look nice to me. It's like, it's as simple as that, you know. It's my aesthetic. I didn't really see a lot of stuff out there that I wanted to wear that was being sold in the marketplace at the time. So I just made it myself. And, you know, it's like, I was never the kind of person that would wear like crazy flashy pants with like donuts on them or kitty cats. And that was another like whole other, you know, that's something that people like, which is totally fine. You can wear donuts on your pants. But for me, it wasn't really, it was my aesthetic. So mm-hmm. I wanted to go in a different direction, and other people were into it too, which was really cool.
People want to wear what you're wearing, or people want to wear what you want to wear.
Yeah,
so
well, I mean, I think that's it's a good way to like navigate through this crazy world of textiles and fashion, because fashion, which I've learned since I got into it, is super cyclical, and it's, you know, stuff goes out of fashion super quickly, because that's how the fashion world works. And, you know, you got to keep turning over things and trends. And when I was doing this, like, I didn't want stuff to only last one season. I wanted it to last for 2 years and still be in style, because I think it's really important that we have pieces that we buy that are going to last us that amount of time, and that are going to like last in quality but also in aesthetic. I hate that throwaway fashion culture of like, yeah, buy it and wear it twice and then throw it away. So I wanted something that was going to have that impact over time.
That comes from your desire to work with the earth, to protect, help the environment.
Like, I don't want to just be in business for the sake of pushing out products to people. Like, I want them to be, I want people to hold on to things for a long time. And I also want to make sure that those things are being made in the most ethical and sustainable way possible.
Of course, that means you have to keep finding new customers.
Yes and no. I mean, I've been pretty lucky to kind of hit this little sweet spot of like, people really like the fit and cut, and the designs keep changing. So they do enjoy freshening up their wardrobes as well. But I think it's that balancing act, right? You know, I used to struggle with it a lot, to kind of try and reconcile my feelings about like putting more stuff out into the world, and also trying to like do more with less. And I mean, my personal wardrobe is quite minimal, actually. You would think I have a million clothes, and I do have a lot of inner fire pants and shirts, but I try not to consume very much. I don't really go shopping ever. I never really have enough time to do shopping. But I definitely now realize like, it's okay. Like, there is going to be a business attached to anything. And as long as I am still staying true to my values and that I'm doing it the right way, it's okay. It's okay to be pushing out product into the world, because if I, you know, am doing something in a way that, you know, everything's locally made, or it's made sustainably, then that'll inspire other people to do the same. And then you'll have other people in that community that are feel like they're capable of also making a change, that there are these smaller businesses that can actually succeed versus the Forever 21s and the H&Ms in the world that are still currently dominating. But when people can see that there's an alternative and that they, yeah, maybe they'll spend a little bit more, but they'll spend money on something that lasts longer, that's going to impact, you know, a person's life directly, it's that much more special than just buying into fast fashion. So we need to be here. Otherwise, the, you know, the big guys in the industry are just going to take over completely, and everything's just going to be homogenized, and poor people overseas are going to have to suffer to produce for the rest of the world. So I think it's important that small businesses are still doing what they're doing.
And your business philosophy reflects your personal philosophy.
Yeah, of course. I don't think there's any other way to do it. Like, I am me, and I don't try to pretend to be anybody else. And I try to constantly stay true to me. And I've also had other people copy me and rip off designs. And that initially really made me feel bad. And, you know, you just kind of like get this feeling in the pit of your stomach, like, oh, I can't believe someone would do that. What do I do? Especially if it's a bigger company copying you and everyone thinks you're copying them, which mm-hmm. has totally happened to me as well. Mm. And it made me kind of realize, like, I can just keep doing what I'm doing and ignore that, because a lot of that energy can be very draining and negative, and I didn't want to be consumed by it. And trust me, I've been through the whole legal rigmarole with this as well. And at the end of the day, I realized, no, I want to put my energy into making what I want to make and continue to like create new designs and come up with new stuff that is going to continue to put myself ahead of anyone else that's out there. Because if I keep being me, then people are going to see that, like, they're going to pick up on that authenticity, and that's all I can do, right? So it's one of those things, like, my personal philosophy is like, it's okay to not be perfect, really. Like, I will do things. It's like kind of the rule of good enough. Like, if I just get this out there, like, you know, it might not be perfect, but at least I will have started that ball, and it's starting to roll now. And there's so many times when I look back and I'm mortified with how I used to do things. Like, there's one example that I always laugh at is I didn't want to buy brand new cardboard boxes to ship stuff in. So I would go to the local grocery store and like pick up all these boxes that they would discard. And I would pack my clothes in these like discarded like grocery store boxes, like ramen noodle boxes. Mm-hmm. And I remember sending them out and being like, oh, they'll totally get it, because like, we're an eco-friendly company. Like, these boxes are going to get thrown out anyways. So, and you're not going to care if the stuff arrives in a box, because you're going to throw it out when you get it. And then like my friends on like, who are kind of like marketing branding people, were like, oh my God, I can't believe you sent your product in a ramen box. And I'm just like, yeah, but and now we don't, but you know, it's one of those things that, that seemed like the most logical thing at the time. And that's because I was being me, because I don't want to create more waste in the world. Why use a brand new carpet box when there's perfectly good one right there?
Makes sense to me.
And I think most of my buyers, like, cause these are all like wholesale orders. They were all people who were like reselling my stock. So, you know, they like, what is this? Did someone like order some ramen? But, I remember actually getting a couple messages from them being like, yeah, thanks for like just sending stuff in an old box, because we discard them anyways.
Really? So
yeah. And that was because I knew nothing about the industry. Like, you know, afterwards you meet people and they're like, no, you should probably put your best impression forward, like, you know, best foot forward. This is like the unboxing experience. Like, now there's like so much around it that, you know, people kind of get caught up in these little details. And it is, I would say, you know, it does set one brand apart from another if you have a really nice unboxing experience. But mm-hmm. at the end of the day, like, it's that, those are the kinds of things that looking back really reflected who I was, instead of just who I should be or what the industry is telling me to do or how I should behave. So I've always been like that.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Now, the first time I heard of your company, mm-hmm. I had ordered a shirt through Etsy.
Oh, yeah.
And so two things that I wanted to talk about. One is you were selling on Etsy, which is pretty cool. And the other was that I got in the package a handwritten note, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of thanking me for the order, which I thought was really cool.
Yeah.
About 3 years ago or
so. Oh, cool. That's awesome.
Once you started looking outside of the market that you could personally connect to, what was your next step?
How did I branch out?
Yes.
Yeah. So the Etsy thing, actually, I started my Etsy store right away. Like, it was pretty easy to get some items listed. Those were like the pictures I took myself and just stuck them up on the website. So that was actually a cool intro to e-commerce. And I was able to like actually pretty quickly get some traction on Etsy. And I think it was just kind of good timing in a way, because at the time, like, slogan shirts weren't really that popular, but now they're like super popular. But, I really just started to learn a lot about e-commerce at the beginning, just through trial and error. So, like, I remember starting up my own WordPress site, which was like totally, like, I don't even know how that thing was ever functional, but it was, because I remember trying to piece together this website through tutorials and plugins and stuff. And it wasn't as simple as it is now, because now you can just like get a Shopify store and plug in a theme and you're all set to go. At the time, it was kind of like the Wild West when it came to e-commerce, and different e-commerce providers were trying to like fight over that market share. But I think what I was really good at doing was actually getting out there in terms of like being in a physical space, and Wanderlust helped me a lot with that. Was I start to branch out from doing local shows to shows that were just a little bit outside of my vicinity, and going to festivals like Wanderlust were awesome because everyone comes from somewhere else, and so they would come to the festival, buy something from me, and then go back home, and then they would wear it. And I was really lucky that my clothing is a walking billboard. So people would just comment and be like, where did you get that? And they'd be like, oh, I got it here. Oh, here's their website. And then that would start to build up our e-commerce sales. So I think a lot of people, when they're starting an e-commerce store, kind of think, oh, this has to be just an online thing. But I think it has to happen in tandem with physical presence. Mm-hmm. Because that's when people are able to like physically feel your product, and when you're talking to people one-on-one too, you learn so much more. There's so much more market insight you get. Like, when I come to these shows, there's a lot of things that I wouldn't pick out, or you know, you just overhear the conversations and they're like, oh yeah, like that, I would like that, except change that, you know. And those are the things that you don't necessarily get online as much, because those people aren't going to like write an online review and be like, I was hoping that the font would be a little bit bigger, you know, like that's not something that someone would say, but you overhear it. And that has informed me so much. And you also get to see how people fit in it, because it's clothing, right? So like seeing different bodies, different, shapes and sizes, men, women, like how does my stuff look on different body types? That was another big insight I got from shows. So it's, you know, I know this is a long-winded answer, but like I think in order to get global, you really have to start with the physical presence and take the risk also to like go travel outside of your own city. Because I definitely noticed that over the past couple of years, now our online sales are good. And I think it's because we did all that legwork and did all those festivals and traveled outside of our own city.
So probably the first Wanderlust you went to was
Whistler.
Whistler,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and that was mind-blowing. Like, that was, up until that point, I'd only just done, like, craft shows and, like, little small events. And then I did Wanderlust, and I was just, I don't know, over the moon, because I found my tribe through Wanderlust as well, because people got what I was putting down. And I remember so many times doing other events where I'm like constantly explaining, I'm like, yeah, so this is like a Sanskrit pun and this is what this word means. And in a way, that's really great too, because it gives people the opportunity to like learn a little bit about the world of yoga and what these things mean. But when you go to Wanderlust, everyone already speaks your language. So it was super awesome. And it was super, I guess just validating. Yeah. And it made me feel like I was actually on the right path and that I could just keep going. And there's been so many times where I would be in such a funk about something small or even something huge. I don't know. Like there's always like those things that just keep like, you just can't kick and you're just like, why am I in this funk or why am I dealing with this? And then you see someone walking down the street wearing your clothes and you're like, oh my God, yeah, like this is real. Like that person's wearing that. And I get that a lot when I come to these festivals because we've been doing them for 5 years now. People come back year after year wearing my stuff. And I'm like, oh my God, I can't even remember the last time I saw that print or that design and they're still wearing it. And it's just, it warms my heart because I forget a lot about what goes out in the universe. Like, you know, but because it's like out of sight, out of mind for me, like I sold the stuff, it's gone. But like seeing people walk around in it, it makes me remember that, yeah, this is all stuff that's still out there floating around and having a positive impact on people.
Do you go to all of the Wanderlust locations?
Yeah, I think this is our like 23rd Wanderlust festival. And I have done all of them. I'm ready now to pass the torch on to my wonderful staff to carry on and do other shows. But yeah, I've done them all and it's really, it's kind of the best experience to be able to work and play sort of in the same place. The one that I'll always do forever is the Hawaii one because you can invite me back every time, I will come back every year. It's never guaranteed either. So, you know, the Wanderlust relationship that we have is we just build up that good rapport with the Wanderlust founders.
Oh, they have to invite you.
Yeah.
Oh.
We apply every year. So it's just, you know, there's only so many spots. So
if an up and comer wants to go and be on Wanderlust, they can't, it's not just there's what I can pay for.
You have to apply and then you get accepted. So, you know, the first couple of years we only did a couple and then we started to get more into it and they asked us back they accepted us to a few more and a few more and a few more, and then before you know it you're doing the whole circuit, which is 5 or 6 festivals in a summer.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah. I think it all comes down to also being a cool person. Like I think a lot of it is just making those connections with people and actually thanking people for all their hard work, you know, like I think the little thank yous go a long way. Like you said, like that little handwritten note. I remember sitting there, like writing notes to all these customers, being like, "Thank you, Brian." You know, like I don't know who this person is, but whatever. It'll make them feel good. And I think that's those little touches make a huge impact.
Definitely.
In the long run.
Yeah. So at this point, how many employees do you have?
I have 7 full time employees now.
Yeah. And does that include the people that travel with you doing the Wanderlust?
No. No, so those ones are friends of mine who work part-time and just do like one-off events here and there, and I just train them up to be able to do the events. But yeah, I have 7 full-time staff now.
So the 7 are back at the home.
Yeah.
Home base.
Some are remote actually, but most of them are home base.
Wow. Mm-hmm. And the business, what's the next step for your business?
That's a big question. I think for me, I really want to focus on product development. In the next year, I want to release some new yoga towels. I want to release a new line of more technical apparel. So there's a lot of stuff that I want to continue innovating on. And it only got, I was only able to really start focusing on this after I hired all those other people because it was so consuming doing all the marketing, all the, like managing all the communities that we have. Like we have a full-on ambassador program now, and it was and all the social media management, oh my gosh, that's so time consuming too. So now that I have people in those places, And I've got a logistics person that also helps with all of our orders and all that stuff, and a wholesale manager. Now I can really focus on building up our products and, you know, figuring out what the next step is product-wise, because I think there's a lot that we can do that builds on what we've created. Like, for example, yeah, those yoga towels, like, that's a pretty easy next step. We, you know, can make them out of recycled water bottles as well, put our prints on them. But I also don't want to just grow for growth's sake. Like, one of my good teachers, actually Ted Grand, who is the founder of Moksha, always said, growth for growth's sake is the anatomy of a cancer cell. And it's true. Like, just growing for the sake of growing doesn't really fulfill me at all. I would personally love to have more spare time. I would love to be able to travel more, and possibly start a family. That's the mm-hmm. other thing. It's like, you know, right now I can't take care of a plant. So I really can't see myself taking care of another human being, but, that's something I want to invite into my life and open up as a possibility over the next couple of years too, which is a big exercise in letting go, because this business is my baby and I want to sort of always kind of nurture it and stay close to it. But now I think I have a lot of capable people that can help me. And it's actually pretty exciting to see myself maybe take a step back and sort of just be the boss and be the one that's like thinking bigger picture, and not so much into the day to day. So yeah. And then we're just going to keep, expanding to new places. Like, we're starting to build up a presence in Australia, a little bit over in Europe as well, which is super exciting. Yeah. So there's always that too, is going abroad.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I went to stop by your booth, mm-hmm. this afternoon, and you weren't there because you were taking a yoga class.
Yes.
And so I guess you're still finding time for yoga, which is fantastic.
Yeah. Well, for me, I always take my practice, how do I say this? My practice is more important to me than my teaching. So I actually found when I was still teaching, I don't teach right now anymore because I travel too much, but, I was still teaching yoga, running my business, and I had no time for practice. Mm. And then I felt super disconnected when I was teaching, and I actually just stopped. I was like, I can't teach something I'm not practicing. So, I stopped doing that and then started practicing again. And now it's still kind of a struggle to find a regular practice, to be honest, when you're on the road all the time. And there's only so much like home practice you can do that, you know, to motivate yourself. I'm really not the best at home practice. But I always value my practice because that's what keeps me grounded. That's what allows me to, escape my own thoughts and my own judgments and brings me back into the present moment. As hard as it is, like, I would say even after all the yoga teacher training I've done and like, you know, the experience I've had, with being a regular practitioner, I still find it hard. And there's always that struggle where you're like, can I just skip this one today? You know, but after every practice, if I can catch a class, and I like to take other people's classes all the time, because that's actually where I got a lot of inspiration for all of my designs.
Really?
Is, yeah. And what I hear in a class, it's like, oh yeah, that's cool. Like, how does that go together? And there's often times where I have to like scooch over and like write a little note down, but, it keeps me creative and it keeps me grounded. So that's something that's super important, is to just stay true to those roots, because if you get too disconnected from it, then you're also not aware of like, of how things are changing. You know, it kind of keeps your thumb on the pulse of what's going on in the world of yoga. So, yeah, I mean, I would say having yoga practice is like, it's fundamental, even if it's once a week, you know, mm-hmm. and that's okay. There was a time in my life when I used to feel guilty about not practicing yoga enough, but I'm a little bit, well, I'm over it now. I mean, there's always, it still happens. I still feel guilt. But it's one of those things that it's always there for me. Same with my meditation practice. Like, it's by no means consistent, but it's a tool that I can pull out of my tool belt and have in order to bring me back to the most important thing, which is being authentic, being, and you know, living the life that I want. Because of course, this is something I've created for myself, and I am fortunate enough to be in a position living in North America to be able to do what I want. We have the freedom here, and not all the people, not, you know, everyone in the world has that freedom. They have constraints and they have to, you know, make the most of what they have to do and do things they probably don't want to do in order to survive. Because I know I have that luxury, I try not to take it for granted at all.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So then this last little bit, we're going to wrap things up in a little, in a mm-hmm. moment. I just want to ask a couple quick questions, and these are really designed for people that, are looking for their own business. People particularly that are involved in yoga.
Yeah.
So thinking about the yogi who most of them are becoming teachers, but you know, some maybe have some other passion that's just like related off the side, a tangent.
Mm-hmm.
So for those people, any advice that you have to give them with respect to life balance?
Yeah, life balance. I think it's the old rule of, you know, when you're on the airplane, they say, you know, put your mask on first before you put your kid's mask on.
Mm-hmm.
Self-care is super important. And I think in order for you to show up for other people, in whatever you do, and this is what happens a lot to yoga teachers. I experienced it too when I was teaching a lot, is like you get burnt out because you're in this giving mode all the time. You're trying to support other people, but then you suffer because you're not giving yourself the care that you need. So I think self-care should be super important. You know, your nutrition, your physical practice or exercise. If that becomes a non-negotiable in your life, then you're able to be that much better to serve other people.
Okay.
So, yeah, don't let, I mean, it's going to happen. You're going to burn out. There's always going to be those moments where you're like, I have not slept in days, or I haven't, you know, I've been on the computer nonstop. But if you can take those moments and pause and just, you know, allow yourself to have the time that you need to reset or whatever it is. So find your practice, whatever it can be. It doesn't have to be yoga either. It could be going for a walk. It can be, you know, mountain climbing or climbing up walls. I don't know. It can be whatever. It doesn't even have to be physical, right? It can just be breath. That's super important.
All right. And your business is different than many that are going into teaching, but mm-hmm. I'm sure some of the same rules apply when we talk about marketing. Any mm-hmm. advice for marketers?
Yeah. I would say for marketing, know your brand. So I know that's a really like vague thing to say, but ask someone else to define you in 5 words. And if you think that's, you know, an accurate description, then figure out ways to sort of distill that down to like maybe like one paragraph or a one sentence message. Like, what's your mission? Like, what's your why, I guess, is another way to put it. So figuring out like, and it doesn't have to, you don't have to know all the answers because my why has changed over the years as well. But if you can distill it down and figure out why you're doing what you're doing, that will help tell your story. And I think that's the most important thing when it comes to marketing, is knowing your why. Everything else sort of comes in after that. So the nice photography or the website or, you know, the bio and all that stuff is great. And the credentials are always great too, but I would much rather know why someone's doing something than like how many yoga teachers trainings they've. Mm-hmm. So the element of knowing your purpose, I think, is the most important.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Do you consider yourself an introvert or an extrovert?
Introvert, actually, which would be probably surprising because I am pretty outgoing and I don't have any issues speaking in front of a crowd or, you know, meeting strangers or anything like that. But I would say, personally, I definitely enjoy my quiet time. I like to be by myself a lot. It gives me time to think, and I really enjoy sort of connecting with things that aren't humans, like being out in nature, being in the ocean, all those things. I don't know if that makes me an extrovert or not, but I would say deep down inside, I've always been an introvert.
Okay. Well, the festivals must be a little challenging then.
The energy is a little crazy. Like, definitely there's moments where I'm just like, oh my gosh, this is overwhelming. Or, you know, there's, it's a full on experience for sure. But I think also when you kind of tap into the flow of things, you can sort of start to ride that wavelength a little bit. But for sure, after a festival, I'm just like, just turn the lights off. I just want to like chill and drink some tea or something.
Yeah.
So yeah. It's a balance for sure. And I think being an entrepreneur has also made me more extroverted for sure. Like I used to not really like talking to strangers. But when the thing about talking to people you don't know is if you just ask them like a couple of simple questions of like, you know, whenever we do these festivals, actually, it's really great. It's good insight actually. Just by asking someone like, you know, how was your class? Because everyone sort of has an experience and they want to share that experience. So just tapping into like what they're doing, you know, because there's so many times when I've seen other people try to sell things and they'd be like, let's talk about the product. I want to talk about these things I'm selling. Mm. And then I see, you know, the customer just being like, oh, I don't want to be sold to. But then and this is like maybe just a selling tip, is tap into the customer's experience. Like what are they experiencing right now? Like maybe they just got out of like the most amazing yoga class they've ever had. And then they, you know, they're talking about it and then you go, okay, like cool. Like let me know if there's anything you need help with. And they're kind of already tuned into this place where they feel like they were able to safely talk about something, or maybe, you know, or maybe it's just a friendly thing, you know, just being able to connect with them. And there's definitely people I've met and have become good friends of mine by just meeting them that way and just asking them how they're doing or what their experience was that day. And then another really interesting marketing thing that I realized we were doing that, like I've read about in marketing articles since then, is I think it's called positive imprinting. So it's when you associate your brand with someone else's positive experience. And being at a yoga festival is exactly that, because people are here having fun and often they buy items to remember the time they had. So, you know, it's like a little like memento or a souvenir. I guess that's what a souvenir actually technically translates to. Whenever they wear that shirt, they're going to remember that good time they had at the festival. And it's a pretty cool thing to be able to associate yourself with someone's really great experience. So, you know, that's what I think when you're in a marketing, when you're trying to market to someone, especially for yogis and artistic people, it can feel like you're just trying to sell something to someone. And it definitely doesn't come naturally to those kinds of creative types. But it's marketing is really just relationship building. So it's just trying to imprint a positive experience on someone and hopefully they'll associate what you're doing or what you're creating with that positive experience.
So if yoga teachers gives everyone a cookie on their way out the door, they're going to get full classes.
Oh yeah, man. There's like some simple hacks to this, right? Like I remember like there was like this one yoga teacher who always had these like lavender scented, like I took these hot classes, right? And she would always have these like, she would have this little like fridge. I think maybe the studio, she would use the studio's fridge and she would have these like lavender scented cold towels that she would give out after every class. And you're just like, I love you so much. So, and I mean, yoga studios, like if they're smart too, are going to pick up on those things. And, you know, how to make someone feel really taken care of, I think is really important.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Last question.
Yeah.
How do you define yoga?
Ooh, that is a good question. How would I define yoga? Well, I would define it the same way the yogis define it, which is unity. I think yoga to me is understanding that we are not that different from each other, and that we as a human race are actually all along the same path together, even though we might be in different places physically or different places time-wise. Understanding that is what will allow us to see the bigger picture and to make a positive change in order to preserve what we have, you know, our precious planet and, you know, the resources that we have. I think when we feel separate from each other, that's when we start to see animosity, hatred, like all this stuff start to brew. And I think what the world needs more is this understanding. It's mutual understanding that, yeah, we are all the same people and we're not trying to fight with each other. We're all in this together, and we have this one world, this one rock in space. Isn't it crazy? I actually saw the eclipse a couple days ago, and it was the most spiritual experience ever. It made me really see myself as one amongst many. And when you're standing there with strangers and you're all in like complete fucking awe of this like celestial event that only happens like once every few years in only certain parts of the world, you're just like, okay, we're all little like ants on this, crawling on this planet. Like there's something bigger out there that, you know, that is worthy of our time, and we have to figure out how to get along and how to like preserve our planet in order to like make sure that this doesn't go away. So that's a long answer, but I think it really is, it does come down to unity and just getting out of your own ego. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, Leah, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, thanks so much, Ryan.
Had a great time.
Thanks.
I hope you enjoyed the chat with Leah Emmett, owner and founder of Inner Fire Brand Clothing. As I mentioned at the top of the show, Leah is offering a 15% coupon code for purchases off of the Inner Fire website. Her website is myinnerfire.com, and be sure to use the coupon code MATCHAT, that's MATCHAT, no space, all caps. I appreciate Leah taking the time out of her busy festival schedule to speak with me, and I hope you enjoy the conversation as much as I did. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. You will find links to some of the topics that we covered in the show notes on the website, yogamat.chat. If you did enjoy the episode, the most valuable way that you can show your appreciation is by spreading the word. You can share the episode in whatever social media you utilize. You can give a review or a rating wherever you listen to the episode. You can subscribe to the podcast so that new episodes will automatically download. And you can follow us on our social media by searching for Chats from the Mat. A special thanks to 13 Hands for giving us permission to use their song Big Love in the opening and closing of the episode. You can learn more about 13 Hands by going to their website, which is the number 13, the word hands.bandcamp.com. Thank you for joining us at Chats from the Mat, yoga-inspired conversations with me, Brian McCrae Davis.
Listen up. Gather round, tell your friends I'm coming to town. I'm selling love, I'm peddling compassion, just basic decent human interaction. It's not an occasion.